Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Back to New Books in History. I'm Mark Clovis, your host for the channel. Today we're talking with Robert M. Browning Jr. about his study of the naval operations in the Gulf Coast region during the American Civil War, entitled Lincoln's Trident, the West Gulf Blockading Squadron during the Civil War. Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure being here.
It's a pleasure to have you. I wonder if you could start us off by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I basically had an interest in military history since childhood. When other people were reading Superman comics, I was reading war comics for some reason. I continued that interest throughout my college career and ended up going to the University of Alabama, where I received my PhD. After that, the first job out of the gate, I was a park superintendent at the battleship Texas. And I stayed there a couple of years and then got a job with the Coast Guard in 1989, and I worked for the Coast Guard for over 26 years, and I served as its chief historian. But I continuously had an interest in military history and Civil War history.
I was thinking how, as I was reading this, that it represents the culmination of so much work that you've done in this, this is, in fact, the concluding volume of a trilogy. And I was wondering if you could explain how it was you came to this particular subject and how it became a three-volume series about the larger issue of blockading the Confederacy during the Civil War.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because it's really not, this is, it may be my third volume, but there are going to be others, because there were more than three squadrons. There was another coastal squadron, which was the East Gulf Blockading Squadron, and there was, of course, the Mississippi Squadron, and then you had what is often called the Flying Squadron or the Cruising Squadron, which is the ships that chase the Confederate commerce raiders all over the planet. So there's, you know, while this is my third book in the series, it's not necessarily my last in the series, because there are other segments of the Union Navy to cover during the Civil War.
Oh, really? How interesting. What about this volume in particular, though? What led you to define it the way that you did, and what led you to make this the next volume you were undertaking in the series?
Well, it's kind of hard to tell, hard to explain to the listeners maybe why you pick a certain avenue or approach. But I'd already covered the East Gulf, the East Coast, and just decided to move into the West. The Gulf squadrons, and wanted to do the West Gulf first because I thought it was the most important. And of course, it includes who I consider probably or perhaps the United States Navy's greatest naval hero, David Glasgow Farragut. And as I got into the research, I was just amazed at what all happened. And I went into the research from the very beginning, and I was not going to make Farragut a hero. In other words, I wanted to come to that conclusion myself. And after reading everything he did, there was just no question in my mind that he is or was who everybody says he was.
One of the other things you do from the start of the book is you describe how important the blockade was to the Civil War. And while I'm not an expert in Civil War history, in so many of the books that I've read about the Civil War, the focus is so often on land operations, or maybe upon, when it comes to the sea, you have, of course, the famous Battle of the Monitor in Virginia, You have the squadrons and say the battles in Europe and so forth. And yet the blockading squadron, as you explained, is really a crucial aspect in terms of defining the outcome of the war. And I was wondering if you could explain why it was so important and what role the West Gulf blockading squadron in particular played in that.
You know, the blockade is often missed during the war because there's most people focus on the Army campaigns, and if the Navy happens to be there, they might get some mention. But the blockade, of course, was the main reason that the Navy was brought into the war, or you know, that was their first mission, was to blockade the southern coast. And you know, what they do during the war is nothing short of amazing, because they start off with 90 ships. And only 42 of those are even in commission, and they have to blockade a long, shallow coast that's over 3,500 miles long with 189 ports or places of entrance. And the West Gulf Squadron had, you know, one of the largest coastlines to cover, because they basically patrolled from Pensacola, Florida, all the way to Brownsville, Texas, and that's just an immensely long coast. Now, the one thing that did make it a little bit easier for them was that they really only had to watch, Mobile, Alabama, New Orleans at the beginning of the war, and Galveston, Texas. Those were the major ports along that stretch of coastline. It's just very important what they did. It basically, for the Union, does a lot of things to the Confederacy. It basically means that they are only going to, once the blockade is implemented, that they're only going to be able to, the Confederacy is only going to have a fraction of their pre-war trade. The Confederacy is also not able to develop a full-scale war economy, and they were not able to import a lot of the materials that they needed to sustain the war. They imported a lot of arms and food and things like that, but some of the larger things that they really needed, like locomotives, steam engineering, some of the largest guns, they just couldn't get them in the quantities that they needed. So what the blockade ends up doing is it isolates the South, and it actually causes inflation and other problems.
And yet, as you describe, the challenges of running this were immense. You already mentioned the amount of coastline that they had to guard, and while it was concentrated on some ports, there's smaller traffic that they didn't ignore. But you also describe how from the start they had these challenges. It was a type of operation that the United States Navy had never really conducted, which was a large-scale blockade in what was essentially hostile waters, because you start by describing how the port facilities in the region were immediately denied to the United States Navy. So not only were they having to maintain this blockade, they were effectively having to do it long distance. And I was wondering if you could explain maybe some of the challenges that posed upon the vessels and the men.
Well, that's correct. And the West Gulf Squadron, being kind of at the end of the blockade, suffered that the most. As you were mentioning, they really don't have bases to operate out of. And at the beginning of the war, they have Fort Jefferson is the only place in the Gulf that they have to operate of, and that's at the very end of the Florida Keys. Now, eventually, Pensacola kind of comes into their hands in May 1862, but still, that's at the very end of the Gulf, West Gulf Squadron's area of operation. So what happens early in the war is again, this is in part because the United States Navy is still very small, and they haven't acquired or built, haven't acquired ships through the merchant fleets, and they haven't built ships, but they have to put sailing vessels off of the coast of Louisiana and Alabama and Texas, because they don't require coal. Having to go from Fort Jefferson and then later Pensacola out to the extremities of the blockade was just not practical. And they sent a steamer fairly early off of Galveston, but she basically just sat there and didn't cruise around because she had to save her coal. Eventually, they resolved that to some degree by taking coal colliers and taking them out to the extremities of the blockade and refueling these ships. But it was still always a problem. And also another issue that they'd had to deal with is because these ships constantly kept their engines turning over and in operation, it ended up requiring a lot of repairs. And so when you take vessels off station, you're weakening the blockade because of logistical issues.
It really becomes clear from the first page of your book that the United States Navy goes into this war really having to scramble because obviously they weren't prepared for it. Nobody was expecting the type of crisis that really just unfolded so quickly. So you describe, and add to which the crisis itself created its own complications, not just the loss of ports, but as you mentioned, it was something like a quarter of the officer corps of the United States Navy resigned. And so you suddenly have all of these positions that are unoccupied. And while people, move up into them, it takes some time to sort out that leadership. That becomes especially apparent, as you explain, in the early months of the blockade, where there seems to be a fairly rapid turnover in the commanders for it. Commanders that were senior, that were there by virtue of peacetime promotions, suddenly find themselves in situations for which they don't really seem prepared.
Yeah, and the Navy had the problem of they basically based their promotions on seniority, which is not, seniority is a small portion of that today, but it's mainly on your abilities. And so what you have in the United States Navy is at the very top, you have a lot of very elderly officers because also advancement during the antebellum days and the antebellum Navy was very slow. So the leaders, the first leaders of the squadron are they're ancient men for their day. And they've been in the Navy for many decades.
The one thing that stood out for me was how often you kept referring to how they began their service or had combat experience dating back to the War of 1812.
That's correct. It's like I said, it's amazing. How far these men could date their careers back.
And yet, helping their offsetting these challenges were the challenges that the Confederates themselves faced. Because while the United States Navy was scrambling to develop this blockade and to man it, the Confederacy was having to build a navy in some respects from scratch. I was wondering if you could explain the challenges that the Confederates were able to pose to this blockade from the start, both in terms of their navy and in terms of their merchant forces.
Well, as you kind of alluded to, the Confederacy started out with really no navy whatsoever, with the exception of the few vessels that they could capture in the ports. I mean, there were some merchant vessels that they got their hands on, but also lighthouse tenders and things like that, so a few revenue cutters. So they really weren't very good naval vessels, and the Confederacy, of course, had to build and acquire a navy as well. But the other thing, so really, the Confederates were not able to challenge the Union Navy at sea. So what they tried to do, of course, is to protect the ports, and they began the war with very few guns or not enough guns. Luckily, they had captured the Norfolk Navy Yard, which had allowed them to fortify a lot of the places along the southern coast. But there are a number of other things that happened. The Confederacy really has no the policies are sometimes not as good as they could be. Particularly, and we can talk about this later, is the blockade running policy. There is no importation policy for the Confederacy, which really impacts what happens. But one of the things that the Confederates did do early on, and it kind of aggravated the enforcement of the blockade, was that they allowed privateers to go out at sea. And all these vessels cruising out of the Confederate ports were were troublesome to the blockade, the Union blockaders. Now, eventually, they are able to control these vessels, and this pretty much stopped, you know, with only a few months into the war. But the Confederacy then pushes this attempt farther by having cruisers, commerce raiders. And this does affect the blockade because there's a huge number of Union ships that are at any one time detached to try to find these vessels. So those are the few things that the Confederacy was able to do. And eventually they built ironclads, which also helped protect the ports.
They also developed a very challenging way of resisting the effort to seize the ships. The United States Navy is operating under admiralty laws and rules that have gone back for some time. And as you explain, as you point out throughout the book, one of the ways that the Confederates would try to avoid having their ships seized was by transferring ownership to European powers, to European parties. And this really complicates the ostensibly straightforward effort of simply seeing a ship and seizing it. Because then there was this question of whether or not there was this political complication. And as you explained, sometimes it would, there's always this potential for a diplomatic crisis that would far outstrip any sort of benefit from seizing that vessel.
Okay, well, at the beginning of the war, the Southern merchants tried to evade the blockade by transferring their ships to either British registry or sometimes Mexican registry or even other countries. And while that may have gotten them mostly out of the country, it eventually wouldn't really help them too much, because what happens is the Union Navy during the war kind of expands the definition of blockading practice beyond what the British had even done. So what could be called contraband was much wider now, but it even went farther than that. And basically, this was judged by the American courts, was that contraband cargoes could be seized at any time during the journey. Beforehand, this was not the case. So, because what was happening during the Civil War, they were bringing these cargoes in very large ships to Havana and Bermuda and Nassau, and then they were putting them on the speedy blockade runners from those points to the south. Well, what the American courts actually eventually established was that any contraband goods, no matter where they are on the ocean, can be seized at any point in the trip. And this would, and when they could prove it, like it was, they were, say buttons for the Confederacy, they knew that was a Confederate contraband. You couldn't say that they were just buttons meant for anybody. So it had to be proved in the court, but this is one of the, it was kind of an expansion of blockading practice. While the Confederates did get beyond it initially, the U.S. federal courts kind of ended up winning in a lot of these things. But there were a lot of gray areas, and there were a lot of court cases, and a lot of these vessels, a lot of the court cases were dismissed in favor of the ship's owners. But in the long run, the practice was expanded, and of course for the British, this was a good idea because they had the largest navy in the world.
You describe a lot of judgment calls being made by captains, and you also reference the fact that for some of these vessels, for the crews, if they seize a ship with a particular remunerative cargo, they could become quite wealthy. You mentioned one ship where the proceeds were equivalent to, I think it was a year and a half of their salaries.
Yeah, that's the case. The Navy had prize laws, and basically, the amounts went to the crew in proportion to their pay, and even the admirals would get money on this. And we'll go beyond the West Gulf blockading squadron and go to the North Atlantic, where they captured a lot more ships. But the admiral that was in charge of that squadron for longer than anybody else ended up with $125,000 during the war in prize money. That was his cut of that. And you know, that's probably 1,000 times his, or 100 times his annual pay there. So it's just a tremendous amount.
So I wonder if we could shift now to talking about the establishment of the blockade in its early months. How did the U.S. Navy go about it, and how did they eventually deal with the issues they were having, in particular with command?
Well, the Navy eventually, as I mentioned earlier, they initially in the Gulf Coast and in a lot of places along the coast, they put up sailing vessels. But one of the things that the Navy's doing at this time is they're purchasing every steamer from the merchant fleet that they can in the United States merchant fleet to put those out there. And of course, these vessels were never meant to be vessels of war. They were meant to carry cargo, so they're not built to carry heavy cannon and extra crew and all these other things. And in some cases, the machinery on these vessels was actually above decks and in full view of the enemy. But you know, they still get them on station. And, you know, they're patrolling as well. And eventually the Navy is building classes of vessels that do make good blockading ships. And they get those on station, as well as some of the fastest blockade runners. So some of the fastest blockaders, the Union blockaders, were ex-blockade runners that had been captured and turned into blockading vessels. Now, what happens is in, you know, the command, of course, is more difficult, because when they have these more ships, they're able to push them out farther to sea. Before, in the early part of the war, they just sat off the coast and you know, pretty much in full view. But as they got more vessels, they started kind of patrolling the shipping lanes. But there's another thing that a lot of people don't realize, and that they don't have a naval background, is, you know, when they look at a map, they just see there's land and there's water. But what happens is you have channels off of the ports, and it basically serves as the same way as highways. In other words, the ships can only go in these channels because of the draft of their vessels. Now, one of the things that the Confederates did was that they built very shallow draft blockade runners, so they could go almost anywhere. Whereas the Union vessels it was dictated that they had to remain in these channels or roadways, or whatever, so they didn't run aground. But basically, getting back to command, it's problematic at times, because what happens is if you have a more senior officer that's coming along the coast, if he stays a couple of days off of one port, he basically is in command, just for virtue of being the senior officer. And it does complicate things for the Union Navy. But you know, I think they overcame all that, and they did a creditable job of stopping Confederate trade.
I got the impression, though, that what drove the appointment of David Farragut to command the squadron was the sense that his immediate predecessors were not being as aggressive as people in Washington were expecting them to be.
Well, yeah, I mean, of all the naval officers during the war, Farragut was probably about the most aggressive of them all, and Farragut was one of these men that he led from the front. In other words, wherever the most pressing part of his command lay, in other words, whether it's attacking forts or the blockade or, you know, getting ready for to capture Mobile or in operations up the river, Farragut was always there. He was he was leading from the front, and that made I think it made a big difference. And there were, you know, I do think that Farragut had some of the best some of the best officers in the service. Now, he had some that disappointed him, and he was quick to let them know that. But overall, he had some of the best. I mean, Henry Bell, who was kind of a almost a contemporary of Farragut, that was also a Southerner that stayed with the Navy. Farragut loved that man. I mean, they were just very good friends, and Bell served him well throughout the whole war as a commanding officer and senior officer off of Mobile, and he later went to Galveston and served in a number of capacities. But Henry Bell was one of his best friends and a very competent and capable officer.
One of the things you do is, while you give Farragut every bit of the credit that he's due, you also described, though, that he had certain limitations. One of the best analyses that you do in the book, I thought, was when you described that he could only do one thing at a time. He did that very well, but he could only really focus upon one task ahead of him. And you also describe how oftentimes after a battle, he was more people criticized him for being more concerned about the condition of his ships than the condition of his men. And you reference, this was in the description of the Battle of Mobile Bay, about how somebody accused him of basically stepping over bodies to check on the condition of the vessel itself.
Well, that's true, and I don't know how you can describe that, other than maybe he had to detach himself to some degree from the carnage that was there. Otherwise, maybe he couldn't function as well.
And you explain how he then, when he assumes command, he begins to then focus upon a succession of tasks. And the first one is the one for which he is arguably most famous, which is the capture of New Orleans. And I was wondering if you could explain a bit how this fit into the broader mission of the West Gulf Blockade Squadron and what Farragut did to effect this capture.
Well, Farragut was given, basically, just to take a half a step back. He was given three goals that coincided after he captured New Orleans. One was clearing the Mississippi, one was capturing Mobile, Alabama, and the other was the blockade. And of course, the first two, clearing the Mississippi and capturing Mobile, required Army support, so the Navy almost set him up for failure. But he went to the West Gulf Squadron as the commander with the initial mission of capturing New Orleans. Now, New Orleans at the time was the South's most important port. It was one of the largest cities. It had manufacturing. It was kind of it's just a very important city for the Confederacy. Now, it was pretty far up the Mississippi River, but down at the very base of it, at the mouth of the river, there were actually five mouths, which looked like five fingers sticking out into the Gulf of Mexico. So what it was requiring is that the Union forces had to blockade all five of those entrances, because some were better than others, particularly for deep drafted vessels, but they still had to watch them all, which kind of was problematic for the Union Navy. But the in part of the overall plan for the Union Navy was to cut the South in half by capturing points along the Mississippi, and they sent a force from north down from the north, going south down the Mississippi, and Farragut was to go from the south end northward, and they were to meet. And of course, to do this, you have to capture New Orleans. They got into the river fairly easily, but they ran up against two very heavily fortified fortifications that were below New Orleans. And to capture the city, they would have to capture these forts or drive the Confederate defenders from them. And one of Farragut's subordinate officers was David Dixon Porter, who was Farragut's foster brother, and he commanded a flotilla of mortar schooners that could fire very large shells at a high arc and come down on the targets. Well, this was their initial solution to basically defeating these forts, was to have these mortar schooners bombard the forts into submission. And after many days of heavy, heavy bombardment, I mean, it's, at times there were two or three shells in the air at one time, they found that it really wasn't knocking out the firepower of these forts. And so Farragut had to decided he had to bypass them. And, of course, initially they had to break through a boom of obstructions, which were old vessels that they kind of chained together across the river to keep the Union vessels from ascending the river. But they broke that, and Farragut, with his command, they go past the forts and, you know, suffer, you know, some casualties, and they basically either drive all the Confederate vessels away, capture them, or sink them. But he's now above the forts, and the Army contingent under General Benjamin Butler is there to eventually take the forts or you know, basically there to capture them, which they do. Farragut, though, goes on up to the city of New Orleans and demands its surrender, and for several days is negotiating the surrender of New Orleans with the mayor and other people until Butler can get there, and he does finally get there, and New Orleans surrenders.
The way you write about it, it's almost a comic opera where nobody's willing to claim to have the authority to surrender the city, but there's also this element of danger because the United States is trying to assert this authority. They're trying to plant the flag, literally, and yet they're encountering a lot of hostility from the town. And as you described, they don't have really the forces to pacify the town. They need Butler's men to come up and do that. So you have this period where these vessels are trying to hold the city. You described it. It got a little hairy at points, but it was not without its element of absurdity to it.
Yeah, it was, because Farragut was demanding the surrender, and the mayor was basically saying, "Well, I don't have any forces here to surrender it, so it's yours, but you know, I have no authority." And again, until Butler and his troops get there, there's a back and forth about how the, you know, the flags need, the U.S. flags need to fly over the Mint and the mayor's office and other places in the city. And the mayor's, again, as you say, is backing away, saying, "Well, I don't have authority, and I can't force my people to do this." So you're right. It is kind of funny, but it's also interesting that, again, if you think about it, these were Farragut subordinates that were handling all this in Farragut's absence, and they did a magnificent job, so that this thing did not boil over. I did a paper at a conference one time, and I said they casted a shorter shadow than Farragut, but they were, you know, they were very important to his successes.
Once the city of New Orleans is captured, Farragut then goes on to continue the process of taking the Mississippi. And you describe these operations as ones in which, at times, the Navy is virtually the only presence in this projection of Union power north, that the Army is not necessarily keeping up with them. So you describe a lot of instances where these vessels are single-handedly taking on Confederate fortifications. And you also describe this almost guerrilla warfare where the Confederates would occasionally not just snipe at the Union vessels, but bring up flying artillery and bombard them as they're traveling up and down the river.
Yeah, and as soon as Farragut is able to consolidate his ships and get ready, he's up at Vicksburg by the middle of May 1862, but there is no army there, so he finds that he there's nothing he can do, and so he goes back down, and he returns in June with a small army force, and at this point there's really nothing at Vicksburg to stop them from capturing it, but they fail to do that. And as you mentioned, all along they do have flying artillery batteries, and what made those small guns so effective, that actually served as defensive positions for these guns. They could almost fire at the Union ships without worry of being fired back upon, because there was because the levees themselves protected the gun crews. But Farragut basically finds in the summer of 1862 with the water now falling to such a degree that he's afraid his ships are going to be trapped up in wintertime, and he has to leave. He has to go back down to New Orleans. So this was a point in the war where had the leadership provided enough troops, they could have captured the whole Mississippi without all the issues later on, but they didn't have any kind of continuing strategy once Farragut got to New Orleans.
That issue of insufficient manpower also plays a role in the failure of the Union to hold Galveston, which was the largest, at that time, the largest port in Texas. I was wondering if you could explain a bit how the operations off Galveston differed from those in around New Orleans, and also how the Confederacy was exploiting the Mexican town of Matamoros, as you described very effectively, to avoid a lot of the efforts of the Union Navy to try to seize Confederate shipments.
Well, Galveston was basically the major port in Texas. When you say major port, you have probably a lot of people have visions of this being something big, but Galveston was very small at the time. And the Galveston had problems as a port. One thing, it had very shallow water there. While it's a major port, it's still very shallow. So the Union vessels had a hard time maneuvering to attack or to even blockade. But the major drawback is the connecting railroads back to the east. So anything that lands there, it can go to railroads like to Houston and to other parts in the state, but then it has to be carried from wagons from there. So it kind of diminishes its real value. In January 1863, the Navy had basically captured the town, but the Army was slow in getting its troops there, and the Confederates recapture Galveston, and basically Galveston remains in Confederate hands until June of 1865. So it was a mistake of just not, one, being late, and then two, not providing enough troops to hold this position. And it was very costly to the Navy during the war because they had to keep ships there to blockade it. Now, Matamoros is a whole other issue. Matamoros is on the Rio Grande River on the Mexican side of the river. And as some people might not know, that, of course, the Rio Grande is the separating border between the United States and Mexico. But from the mouth of the river, that miles out to sea from the land. Now, so the Confederates were able to do was they were able to ship stuff to Brownsville or whatever, have it cross the river and be shipped out legally through Matamoros because that was a neutral port. And trade grew exponentially here during the war. Just to put it in perspective, in 2 years, statistics. There was in 1861, there was only one ship from New York that had cleared to go to Matamoros. In 1862, there were 20 from New York. And in 1863, there were 72 from New York that cleared to go to Matamoros. Now, of course, they're carrying out cotton from Matamoros, and they're carrying in often supplies that could help the Confederacy. So it's really a kind of northern merchants helping the Confederacy and making a lot of money.
And as you described, you also have the diplomatic complications of how there's a multinational operation in Mexico in 1863 regarding national debt, and how that morphs into a French occupation and an empire-building effort in Mexico, which means that they're not just dealing with the Mexican government, they're dealing with all these European governments who have a very forward presence and who certainly are not going to brook violations of the sovereignty of their ships.
Well, that's correct. You have French presence there as well as the British presence there. And of course, you have a lot of British merchants there, also bringing supplies. And what happens is there are some seizures of British ships down there. Some were legal. A lot of them were later deemed illegal. And again, it's part of it was part of the inaccuracies of exactly, where is the line that comes out to sea. And you know, the American companies were very aggressive and would seize them, and the courts would later find, well, no, they had just, you know, a storm had caused them to drift over the line or whatever. So, but, you know, it caused a lot of hard feelings between particularly the British and the Americans over some of the activity that was going on right off of Matamoros.
As you described, once Vicksburg is captured in July of 1863, Farragut's able to shift his attention to the other major port in his area, which is Mobile. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the operations around Mobile and the effort that he undertakes to both to capture the port.
Well, Mobile at this time is really the Gulf's most important port. It's a deep water port. It's Mobile, Alabama itself sits, you know, way up in the bay, and so it's out of reach of direct naval assault, and it had been one of the original targets for Farragut when he first took command of the squadron. And he starts off, you know, bombarding. There's a fort on the west side of the bay that he bombards. I think he said it was just more or less for entertainment. I'm not sure the exact words, but it was along those lines. And of course, the Confederates know that this is going to happen, and they've built up the defenses all around Mobile. They have a fort at the mouth of the river. They have they have torpedoes or mines, as most people would recognize most of the day. And they have one of the most powerful ironclads, the CSS Tennessee, also protecting the bay with a few other gunboats. Well, Farragut basically has to wait for months, waiting for the army to make this a priority. Because again, it's like in other places that he could pass by the forts, but there's no reason to if you don't have the troops to hold it. Eventually, he gets a commitment from the army, and it's basically because of the Atlantic might be a valuable place to capture, because it might assist with the Atlanta campaign. But about the time he gets the commitment of this, they decide to go on another campaign up the Red River, and that delays this whole process for another couple of months. Well, eventually he gets part of the troops that he thought he was going to get, but the Union commander, who was very good, basically said, I can take, you know, this other side if you can pass the forts, and once you pass them, then we can supply you from the western side. So basically, Farragut's preparing for this. He's actually sits in his cabin on the Hartford, which was his flagship, and he has blocks of wood shaped like ships that he pushes out along the floor, trying to figure out the best way to attack Mobile and get his vessels past the fort at the throat of the harbor. And he eventually decides to pair his ships up. And what he has is a powerful ship on one side and one of the smaller gunboats on the other side. And the reason he does this is in case the larger ship gets damaged so that the engines can't run, the smaller ship can carry it on into the harbor. But he basically lashes all of his, you know, the ships that he's going to take into the attack together, and they, on August the 5th, 1864, they start heading to the harbor. Now, they also have four ironclads or four monitors that are attached to this attacking column. Of course, he basically had to beg to get these, and he finally did. The monitors, though, as they're all going in kind of together, the monitors are to precede all the wooden vessels. And the monitors, though, were slower than Farragut anticipated, and they basically, what happens is that they cross right in front of the paired up wooden ships right before they get in the harbor. And the lead monitor, which was the Tecumseh, decides to cut across torpedo field to go after the Tennessee, and this was a mistake because the Tecumseh ran on one of the torpedoes and sinks. Well, this kind of throws the whole Farragut's whole battle plan into confusion because this monitor sank right in front of the wooden ships, and they really can't pass over top of it because this thing is so huge. It rising off the bottom, it could rip the bottom out of any of the wooden ships. So the lead ship, which was not Farragut, it was the Brooklyn with Captain Alden commanding. He starts backing. Well, that just makes the whole battle plan even worse because now you have backing ships. They're starting to bunch near the harbor. The current is taking them into the harbor because Farragut wanted this to be the case in case they were disabled, if the current would help them get in. And as Farragut's ship comes up to Alden's, he decides he has to take the lead. He makes a split second decision and he takes the lead and goes on into the harbor. Then they go over the torpedo field and they can hear the torpedo off underneath the ships, but they just didn't blow up. The fuses went off, but the explosions didn't. And of course, as all the ships follow Farragut in, they have to contend with the CSS Tennessee that's right there, trying to damage severely each one or each pair as they pass by. Eventually, they all get in, some with some very bad casualties, but they all the pairs do get in, and they eventually have a battle within the bay between all of Farragut's ships, which now have become unpaired. They've cut the lashings, and they're all independent ships now against the Tennessee. And the monitors are pounding its armor, and the other vessels are trying to ram it, and it's kind of this giant melee. One of the people that saw it said it was like a wild pack of dogs after a bear. But eventually, they caused the Tennessee enough damage on the Tennessee that the ship has to surrender, and it pretty much ends the Battle of Mobile Bay.
And they eventually capture Mobile itself, but not till the very end of the war, though the battle itself seems to have effectively ended its usefulness to the Confederacy as a port for blockade running.
It does, yeah. It once they get in the bay and can stay in the bay, that ends Mobile's basically its reason for being almost. And Mobile doesn't fall until April 1865, again because of the defensive works around this that they had built up around the city. It just made it very difficult, and also the shallow water that the Union vessels had to operate in.
Overall, what would you say is the legacy of the blockade in terms of the Civil War? Does it? We've already talked a bit about how important it was to ending Confederate trade. Do you think that in the end it really succeeded in shortening the war or defining its shape in a way that it might not have been had it not existed? And did it do anything with regard to the U.S. Navy in terms of defining its history as a fighting force?
Well, I definitely think it shortened the war. As I mentioned earlier, the Confederacy was basically limited to a fraction of its pre-war trade. They were never able to develop any kind of a full-scale war economy, and it forced the Confederacy in the things it imported. It forced the Confederate leadership to make a decision. It isolated the South, and it caused inflation. So along those lines, it was tremendous. I mean, had the Confederacy been able to import marine engines and all the cannon it needed, locomotives, there were short of locomotives, railroad iron, and the things that could have helped to helped it sustain its war, the war machine, the machinery of the war, it's no telling how long the war could have lasted. But that alone, I think, was, shortened the war by a long shot. As far as what it does to the Navy, I think the Navy, which was, as I had mentioned earlier, was 90 ships and 42 in commission, ended up the war with over 600 ships on the rolls. That definitely created a situation where the European nations were now taking a look at the United States, and you know, they have ocean-going ironclads like the New Ironsides, and the monitors were, you know, were very fascinating for the Europeans, although they were really only good for more or less for harbor defense. That had never been able to really go to Europe and attack fortifications over there efficiently, but they were very good for harbor defense. So I think it was probably the point where the United States Navy had an awakening. Of course, shortly after the war, they kind of have a retrenchment, and it's not until the 1880s until they really again start trying to build a navy on an international scale. But I think again during this period, it definitely had the European nations looking at it.
It really does demonstrate the ability of the Navy to adapt to a type of situation that had really never been prepared for, and really distinguished itself in its ability to do that. This is one of the things that I kept reflecting upon as I was reading chapter after chapter, was that how they were really having to do a lot of this stuff on the fly and without any sort of real experience or tradition to fall back upon. They had not tried to blockade Mexico, for example, during the Mexican-American War. They had not had any sort of, you know, opportunity to do anything even remotely like this during the War of 1812. And yet, war, they really become a modern industrial navy that's able to conduct a very large-scale operation like this.
Yeah, well, actually, they did blockade the Mexico a little bit, but it wasn't anywhere near the effort that it was during the Civil War. And then you might add to that is just the brown water operations, the operations up the rivers and things were just basically, if you think about it, the Union Navy defined the reach of the Union armies during the war. There's hardly any place where you have Union armies that aren't supported by the Union Navy somewhere. So I think that, you know, that's just something else that can be, you know, the listeners can think about, is that the Navy defined the reach of the Union armies.
That's a good way of putting it. Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, could you tell us what you're working on now?
I am working on the squadron I had mentioned earlier, the cruising squadron, or the vessels, the Union warships that chase the Confederate commerce raiders all over the globe, like the CSS Alabama and the Shenandoah, and all the things that go on behind the scenes, trying to track these ships down and end their forays into the United States merchant fleet.
Well, it sounds like you're developing not just a history of the blockade, but really a general multi-volume history of the U.S. Navy and the Civil War. It sounds like quite a formidable undertaking.
Well, that's kind of my goal. Maybe if I live long enough, I'll get through all the squadrons. But that's my eventual goal.
Well, I hope you do achieve that goal. And Bob, thank you very much for taking some time out of your schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
All right. Thanks. Happy to do it.